Church. Frank is retired from the faculty at Roanoke College, Physics Department.
Yes.
And whenever I hear Frank speak, I always impressed because he comes well prepared and with clear ideas. And so he's talking today about how the earth is, the heat problem, how the earth is going to cool down. Okay, Frank, we're very pleased to have you.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here, and I want to thank you for inviting me. Cynthia was out in the garden working, and I rushed out. Unfortunately, she can't be here. So, the title of my talk is Religion's Heat Death Problem, and I timed it, and it will be 20 minutes and 35 seconds, approximately. Okay. So I'm going to read it for time, so I'll get through everything. In my moments of despair about the human race, my thoughts often drift to the possibility of extraterrestrial life and intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. If we can't pull it off, maybe they can. The universe, after all, appears to be life-promoting. The processes from which life emerges appear to be ingrained in the physical and chemical properties of matter. If we make the eminently reasonable assumption that there is life elsewhere, what does that say about widely held religious beliefs of earthlings? Will life last forever? If it doesn't last forever, why does it come in the first place? There are a number of non-theistic ways of thinking religiously about the universe. I won't just talk about non-theistic ways. I'll do both. For example, one way is to contemplate that occurrences of life and consciousness, and even important parts of human culture like ethics, are not an accident, but are hidden in the seeds of the universe's makeup. Let me explain what motivates me to this view. From bees to birds and all higher organisms, we readily recognize instincts throughout nature for self-sacrifice devoted to protecting offspring. We also recognize the intense interest in human society to develop this protective instinct beyond family, beyond tribe, beyond nation, and onto the entire human race, and even to all living things, as in Albert Schweitzer's philosophy of reverence for life. I believe such noble aspirations of humanity are a reflection of our advanced natures and quintessentially religious. They are quintessentially religious. To explain my more expansive view of religion, consider pantheism, which popularly identifies God with the physical universe, but effectively eliminates any traditional concept of a God apart from and above the physical world. Einstein's pantheistic God, he said, is Spinoza's God. That's the 6th to 17th century philosopher, which is identical to the strictly deterministic and intellectually intricate physical laws that govern the world. Is nature itself fundamentally intelligent and even imaginative? I agree with physicist extraordinaire Paul Davies, who concludes that the universe is indeed disposed to promote life and consciousness. I suspect there are many physicists like me who would agree with him. There appears to be a sort of intelligence inherent in nature. It is manifested in processes that are sometimes destructive, sometimes creative. In this way, nature appears to thrash through the possibilities for higher development, much like we see in biological evolution. Two steps forward sometimes, one step back. In this seen mathematically, nature presents us with puzzles that are very complex, intricate, and indeed intellectually beautiful. Studying and learning about nature has aroused in me the experience of encountering intelligence. It's an astounding thing. I never sought that experience. It came to me. Perhaps the superhuman cosmic mind is sentient, but probably not. Perhaps personal, but as Einstein believed, almost certainly not. Perhaps especially caring for human beings, but almost certainly not, etc., etc. But what when the universe's behavior is analyzed from a scientific, particularly a mathematical perspective, there is a strong impression that an intellectual character in it, that there is an intellectual character in it that summons us to wonder and to indulge in the intellectual pleasure from its contemplation, if you have that kind of orientation. Is there any purpose in nature's working? Purpose and deliberation are central to the human experience, and it would be surprising if there were absolutely nothing of a teleological character like purpose, or at least progress, in natural phenomena, despite most biologists' antipathy to this idea. And I'm quite familiar with that antipathy. The de facto progress in organization and consciousness is the most baffling and wondrous thing. The question can be put this way. Are humans the most successful attempt on Earth of nature's effort to know itself, to be self-conscious? This idea comes from a great physicist, John Wheeler, who recently died. A more recent strain of non-theistic religion is known as religious naturalism, wonderfully described in biologist Ursula Goodenough's beautiful book, The Sacred Depths of Nature, and the more recent books by another biologist, Stuart Kaufman, in his technical book, The Origins of Order, and less technical books at Home in the Universe, Investigations, and his recent 2008 book, Reinventing the Sacred. For Kaufman, the sacred is the inherent creative nature of natural processes. For Goodenough, the epic of evolution is sacred in itself. In the discussion to follow, I will talk about the heat death implications of the second law of thermodynamics, not just for theistic religions, but also for pantheism and religious naturalism. Before starting, let me tell you a short story about an encounter with the second law of thermodynamics. If you know just a little biology, you know that even the simplest bacterium is extremely complex. Proof of intelligent design? Well, by God, no. Oh, I mean by Darwin, no. But this claim was made by a fundamentalist minister I debated a while back at Salem High School. Says the minister, the second law of thermodynamics shows that everything gets more disorderly with time. But life is exquisitely orderly. It violates the laws of physics. So we need God to produce life. Okay. Now, the reality is that the second law applies only to isolated systems, and Earth is anything but isolated. It constantly gets energy from the sun because the sun is hotter than Earth. And indeed, if you look carefully, you see that temperature differences are very important for life, even for human industry and other human endeavors. You need temperature drains. Look at a nuclear power plant, for example, or a coal-fired power plant. So let me say a few words about thermodynamics. The two laws, there is a third, I won't say anything about it. The first law of thermodynamics simply identifies heat, or more technically thermal energy, as another form of energy that can transform into mechanical and chemical energy, etc. The second law of thermodynamics, you know it. You'd be surprised how much you know about it. There are many forms, all of which apply, again, only to isolated systems that are seemingly different, but the statements are really equivalent. One of the joys of studying thermodynamics is to see the arguments that make these statements that seem so different actually equivalent. You have to make mathematical and modular arguments to do it. Okay, everybody knows this form. Heat flows from hot to cold, never the reverse, okay? You put an ice cube in a glass of water. The ice cube melts, and it makes the water colder. You don't suck heat from the ice cube and make the water warmer, okay? Everybody knows that. Second version, disorder always increases. That's a kind of picky one because you have to define disorder very carefully and mathematically. Number three, and I think some of you might be familiar with this one too. A perpetual motion machine is impossible. Consequently, when enough time passes, everything in the machine and the isolated system it's in eventually reach the same temperature. Okay? This is the classic heat death before the expansion of the universe was discovered. A most important consequence of the second law for our purposes, if you really wait long enough, much longer than the lifetime of the universe, okay, different energy forms in an isolated system eventually degrade into the lowest form, which is, in fact, heat. And over enough time, everything has the same temperature. So keep that in mind. Now let's look at the heat or cold death, really, that's a more appropriate term, of the Earth, solar system, and universe. Okay? When all energy forms in an isolated system eventually come to the same temperature, there is nothing to drive any machine or organization. As I said, this is the heat death. In the solar system and universe at large, not only does everything eventually reach the same temperature, but because the universe expands, the common temperature drops towards absolute zero, the lowest possible temperature. A more appropriate term, therefore, is the cold death, as I've said. There are three aspects to the issue, therefore. The finite time for life to thrive in our solar system, which a lot of people say, oh, we have about 5 billion years left on the sun. Actually, if you look at how the sun evolves, it's really less than that, about 300 million to a billion years we have. Okay. Down the road a bit. Second, the likelihood of life elsewhere in the universe and what it means for religion. That's another aspect of this whole issue that I mentioned. And third, the likelihood of life throughout the universe being totally extinguished in hundreds of billions of years, but the possibility that life can nonetheless continue. The possibility. Forever. Possibly. Now let's look at the implications of the solar or universal heat and cold death for various religious systems. I'll start with apocalyptic Christian fundamentalists. I mean, what do they care, really? They denigrate the whole idea of materialism. They don't believe in the material world, at least many of them, at least in the popular, the common person. They believe in heaven as an immaterial thing. The soul survives. Paradise awaits. It's all in the plan. The sooner, the better. You can hear that kind of talk around. The universal cold, the same thing. Now let's consider liberal or mainstream Christians. I put Muslims and Jews in here too, but I'll just say what I know about Christians. The vast majority of them, well, especially, I want to focus especially on scholars of natural theology. And I know I'm good friends with the natural theologian at Roanoke College, Ned Wisniewski. And we team taught for many years. And of course, we were on opposite sides of the spectrum on a lot of things. Natural theology, however, is the investigation of what nature tells us about God's nature if you're a theist. The end of the solar system and human life on us suggests that if the creation at large is good, that there should be extraterrestrial life, at least as developed as humans. So let's look at the implications of extraterrestrial life for religion. I got a lot of this from Paul Davies' wonderful book, Are We Alone? The detection of messages from extraterrestrials, they'd have to be intelligent, or appearance of them on Earth poses special problems. Are they human just like us with all our grandeur, but also our foibles, faults, and self-destructive behavior? Or are they moral splendors? The second question, God is understood to intervene in human affairs by theists. It's an important thing. The most important intervention by far being the incarnation of the Son of God, which ascribes to God an essential humanness. This incarnation is ultimately for the purpose of renewing and perfecting the entire creation, including the material creation, the material world, in preparation for the kingdom of God. If there are intelligent extraterrestrials, has intervention by incarnation been done for them too? If so, how does this square with the Bible? Well, there are many ways to unsquare with the Bible. We all know that. A third issue, are they superhuman, as they would need to be to get even get a message to us? And if they appear, would they appear to be gods to us puny humans? Because we're not at that stage at all. And if superhuman, as they likely would be, would they have an extremely advanced science and religion philosophy that would dominate us and put us and our religious faith to shame? Or by some incredible stretch, would they have the same beliefs? Are many of the so-called miraculous phenomena reported in the Bible and other sacred texts just encounters with extremely advanced, godlike, natural creatures? And you hear some talk of this by anthropologists, that when a very primitive culture encounters an advanced culture, they really do have this, get this godlike sense of who the more advanced cultures are. Suppose intelligent human-like aliens make machines that are as intelligent, conscious, and emotional as human beings. I dissent from this view, but I'll continue with it. They would easily pass a Turing test, for those of you who know what a Turing test is. Suppose also that the machines follow their creator's example and create new machines more advanced than they are. It is these machines which would most likely survive a trip through space and make appearance before us. Do they have souls, these advanced machines? Turning to universal cold now for the long term, we're talking hundreds of billions of years, much longer than the age of the current universe. Why life? Literal belief in the creation's goodness implies that life in the world, whether earthly or extraterrestrial, should continue. But all that we know of astrophysics argues against it. Why then should we have life? Theistic religions try to make sense of the world, but if life vanishes, there is no sense to it. Resurrection after death. The belief that Jesus' body rose from the dead and ascended into heaven is extremely significant for Christians as proof that life triumphs over death. So where is Jesus' body? If in heaven, then heaven is not just spiritual. What are the theological implications? Does the body of Jesus live or go into deep freeze with the rest of the universe? Well, let me turn away from these traditional theistic beliefs and look at religious naturalism, which might be more akin to the feelings of some of the people in this group. Stuart Kaufman ignores the solar heat death completely. He focuses on the immediate threats we pose to ourselves and hopes that his reinvention of the sacred can be adopted more widely for our ultimate benefit. Ursula Goodenough resigns herself. She really advocate her book. It's a very thoughtfully written book. Short, too. I like short books these days. Ursula Goodenough resigns herself to an end of it all. She says towards the end of her book that life is a sacred circle that requires no further justification, no creator, no purpose other than the continuation, that the continuation continue until the sun collapses or the final meteor collides. That's a quote from her book. Towards the beginning of the book, Goodenough talks poignantly of the, quote, nihilism that lurks in the infinite and the infinitesimal, and despairs of answering the big questions. She instead finds solace in resignation before the conflicting tendencies of nature, and she focuses on the experience of the mystery and awe of the natural world as it is. She just stands before it in awe, which I think is also a quintessentially religious experience. Universal cold, Kaufman ignores the heat death per se, but towards the end of his book, Investigations, he speculates, just as a quick aside, that energy in the vacuum of space might be tapped. He's an inveterate optimist. He totally avoids the issue in his most recent book, Reinventing the Sacred. And as mentioned, Goodenough despairs of answering the big questions, including the universe going cold. Let's turn now to pantheistic intelligence. Einstein, in his essay Cosmic Religion, human desires are a vanity. Strict determinism governs the behavior of the universe. Time doesn't even have a preferred direction. All the microscopic equations of physics are time reversal invariant, with a very teeny-weeny exception. So forget about what happens in the future, he says. He didn't know about that exception. Davies, in The Cosmic Jukebox and many other books, wonderful books that Davies has written for the layperson, just takes this as a given that life will end in the solar system. Well, what about universal cold? Einstein, again, he died in 55, I think, before the Big Bang Theory was founded. Nature is a value in itself, and humans are insignificant anyway. For Davies, no way out unless physics discovers some new source of energy and how to handle the issue. Buddhist and Hindu systems, I can't really talk about them except to say that Hindu cosmology is cyclical, as the physical universe might also be. A cyclical universe was recently proposed as a possibility by one of the founders of the well-known inflationary theory of the Big Bang, which began with Alan Guth in 1981. But he now believes, this is Paul Steinhardt at the University of Pennsylvania, he now believes that inflationary theory, as currently formulated, has serious flaws. This is really causing an uproar in the community. So my final section here, I have to talk about some speculations. Is there any way out of the heat death of the universe? Maybe, maybe not. There are cosmological speculations galore, however. I just mentioned one, the cyclical universe, even though it's not comforting to think that everything ends in a big crunch. Who knows what would come out of it? Here are two more hopeful speculations. First, Freeman Dyson, in his Reviews of Modern Physics essay article, heavy technical article, Time Without End, believes that consciousness and sentience depends only on structure, not what makes up the structure. Okay. Then he says life is free to evolve into whatever material embodiment best suits its purposes. As the universe cools, two things can happen. He proposes thought processes speed up. And he proposes a physical theory for this. Then it's plausible. And secondly, to replenish energy as the universe cools, organisms go into longer and longer periods of hibernation while storing up energy from the very low temperature of its surroundings to live another day. The organism ends up, by his scheme, living forever, going into these longer and longer periods of hibernation. Davies, in the last 3 minutes, there is no way out unless some new energy source is discovered. Okay, my final section, okay, final page. The current rage, too highly hyped by Scientific American and other such popular publications, consists of far-out ideas about parallel universes, multiverses, and the like. As just mentioned, one foundation of Big Bang Theory, inflation, is now in deep trouble. Cosmology is a very young science. For perspective, consider thermodynamics, initially formulated in an elementary but very useful way almost 200 years ago, when only equilibrium situations were well described. Non-equilibrium thermodynamics, the next irreversible processes, the next development, dates back to about 1931. And this new extension didn't really achieve a developed form until after World War II. Even then, only small deviations from equilibrium were theoretically explained. Starting in the 1970s, thermodynamics was again extended to include systems far from equilibrium, giving rise to the extremely important phenomenon of self-organization, which is a very hot subject today. Cosmology is much younger than thermodynamics. It is a very dynamic science, and we can expect many surprises and revisions of existing ideas in the future. In particular, the thermodynamic theory of the universe and implications for its behavior are a still-to-be-completed project. For example, the entropy of gravity and global energy conservation and general relativity remain to be clarified. Many mysteries remain, and many may never be solved by our species. I thank you very much for your interest and consideration. And anxiously await your questions.
That was too short.
Oh, dear. It was with my ad-libbing, it was 25 minutes
well,
and 42
few,
seconds.
We normally go around the room, but we'll take a few questions that are ready. Okay, Annie.
I can't tell you, I can't cite the authors, but we have been reading some theoretical and research data looking at the possibility of mining the energy in dark matter.
Yeah.
The possibility of what?
Mining the energy that is in dark matter. Can you talk on that?
Oh, I can talk just a little bit from what I know. Dark matter, there are various theories of it. For example, WIMPs, weakly interacting
massive
particles. Thank you, Dan. Yeah. If they're weakly interacting, it will be hard to get the energy from them, I think. These particles are extremely heavy by current theories. I think 200, 300 times a proton mass, something like that. It's very speculative, but perhaps. There is what is called a zero-point energy that is throughout every bit of space, and that has been talked about being mined, as Kaufman and Davies referred to it. But again, no evidence of it to date.
I was reading about one of the theories about, like, I guess they call it the big bounce, that the universe infinitely contracts and expands.
The big bounce, the cyclical universe, yes.
And I was reading something in the news, like there was a new theory that that might be plausible that was not that long ago. I think it was like this past November and December. What, I mean, it's intuitively it seems to me like things are cyclical, but that's just my feeling, so I gravitate towards those kind of theories. I'm curious what your thoughts are on those kind of theories versus linear time, things ending, cooling off, or if they're, you know, if you see a possibility.
Well, on the bounce and the cyclical universe, yes, I think that's a very appealing idea. I mean, actually, I'm a steady state aficionado, although there's just not evidence for it. It's very difficult to support that point of view. Philosophically, I'm for the steady state. The cyclical idea is another possibility, but again, at this point, I reiterate, the cosmology is just a very young science, and all of these ideas are very speculative. I tend to keep my reservations with them, perhaps more than others do.
Well, I'm just kind of curious, like, your knowledge of, like, the current theories and the current things. I know we don't know all these things yet.
Yeah.
We're just speculating at this point, but the theory of the linear universe ending in heat death versus the cyclical universe with the big bounce, like what's the sort of debate going on? Which side has more evidence for?
Uh-huh.
Could I just add to that question, because that interests me too. Since everything we know now indicates that the universe is expanding at an ever rapid pace.
Accelerating
pace.
Yes.
What is there that could possibly pull it back into another Big Bang?
That's right.
That'll change the rules.
Yeah. Well, this comes from a constant, the cosmological constant that Einstein said was his biggest blunder, because he wanted a static universe, and he put it in there to counter the gravitational attraction. But the cosmological constant is a part of that picture, and there are theories about it. Unfortunately, you have to fine-tune things to such a degree, like 1 part in 10 to the 100 or something like that. This gets into the cosmic coincidences of the fundamental constants. which is overplayed, I think, and overemphasized. But as far as the evidence goes, you know, there's tremendous evidence for the inflationary theory. Read Paul Steinhardt's article in the most recent Scientific American. He gives all the evidence for inflation. You look at the cosmic background radiation.
What do you mean by inflation?
Inflation means that at a very early stage, from 10 to the minus 34 seconds to 100 times later, which is 10 to the minus 32 seconds, after the Big Bang, the universe underwent a rapid exponential expansion that flattened out space and time. Okay? Because when we observe, it looks like space is flat. Although with the accelerating universe now, it might be hyperbolic, a bit of hyperbolic in it. Okay, so I just don't know what to say. I mean, again, I'm just not judging one or swinging one way or the other at this time. John?
Well, for many years, we've been hearing about how humans were going to destroy the environment, destroy the Earth, the atomic bombs or reactors and everything. In reality, do you think that there's anything that humans can do to change these theories? That is, cause it to happen, stop it from happening? Do you think humans are anything but a gnat on the nose of the universe?
I think that humans are up and down, left and right, in and out, bad and good. It's all over the place right now. And in this country, we see which way it's swinging. I don't like it at all. But the right wing in this country has really succeeded in squelching talk about population control. And that is a very serious issue. And people say, oh, well, by 2045, I think it is, the population will be 9 billion. They just take that as a given. Okay? And if we do that, if we go that route, we let population continue to expand. And one of my colleagues at Roanoke College, the fellow I team taught with, but another in the religion department, he says, oh, 300 billion people. We can have 300 billion people on Earth. Well, maybe if we live like gnats, yes. But otherwise, we have to address population. I think that's crucial. And we have to address our glug ways. Consume. If we don't do that, I think we're in for it. David?
With the Drake equation, it seems like it must be likely, regardless of what values you put in there, that there are some other intelligent civilizations. But as you were, I think, alluding to, it's almost impossible. I mean, I just found out the other day that it's, from where we are in the Milky Way, it's about 25,000 light years to the center of the Milky Way.
Yes.
And with these vast distances, even if there's anything else out there, it seems like it's just virtually impossible, irrelevant to us. We'll never be able to communicate.
Well, not unless you find a way around the speed limit, the speed of light. Okay.
I'm just amazed at the vastness of these distances. We can't even think about them.
No. Yeah, you're right there. But you know, you look at I'm almost, I'd say I'm 80% confident that there's life throughout the universe that is quite common. You look at certain developments in recent years, like the discovery of extremophiles, organisms that can live in environments that we thought would be killers, you know, high temperatures, the cryophiles, the thermophiles that can live at very low temperatures, the thermophiles at very high temperatures, the acidophiles or whatever you call them that can live in high acid.
Humans in New York City.
Yeah. Humans in New York City. Yeah, some of us have it tough. But you look at all, like I say, life, the universe does seem to be life promoting. There's something in the basic structure of the universe that says life, to me, anyway. Dan.
Since I have a physicist cornered for the first time in years, I have this question, ordinary, stupid question I've had in my head for a long time. Does gravitation act at the speed of light, or does it act instantaneously across infinite distances?
Oh, at the speed of light.
So why in the world, in my elementary physics text, the Caltech, was that not built into the equations, since they knew about it already then?
Well, I mean, if you want it built into the equations, you have to. It's I've never really gotten into it. It's tense, a lot of tensor calculus, and the math is very daunting. The people who are investigating, trying to detect gravitational waves, are into this, and it's just a theory. You know, it comes from the general theory of relativity, you know, which I know something about. But boy, it's a tough subject. You know, I don't know it in its most detailed form.
So most of us simply aren't bright enough to deal with it, for all practical purposes.
Well, there are more than 12 people in the world who understand general relativity. That was the line that was coming out when Einstein first proposed.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
there are
thousands, thousands of very sharp people around the world who understand
back
it.
In the corner.
I'm not one of them. Yes.
This is actually for Dan, but Chandra is a new one, actually, which is the new interferometer gravity observatory. That's actually
spatial.
We also have LIGO, which is actually supposed to basically be able to detect gravity waves, though, here on Earth.
Right.
And this is actually really cool. You have to go look this up, though. And Bob Gowdy, actually, out at VCU back in Richmond, he's actually a huge gravity researcher.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So this wasn't the right physicist to ask?
No, we specialize. I'm the medical
guy. I knew that.
So,
okay.
You know, we specialize.
That's right. My background is condensed matter physics, critical point phenomena, and it's pretty far removed from astrophysics, but I've taught astrophysics. I've loved it all my life, studied it, and I read a lot of books ranging from, and articles in it, tried to educate myself on as many fields in physics as I'm interested in. Millie.
This is really over my head. I don't understand it.
Okay.
But I'm reading a book, Passions of the Mind, and it's about the life of Sigmund Freud.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it has made me realize how we are continuing to evolve. We are not at a stage now where we understand what's going on. He was living during a time when people were concerned only about they knew only about physical things, and they were attributing all these kinds of mental situations to something physical, and he didn't believe that it was, and he didn't
Who,
know.
Who, Freud?
Freud.
Yes.
And he opened the doors to the unconscious and the conscious mind. He opened the doors. Before that, they had no idea. They just attributed it to physical things. And I feel that is where we are today in looking at space. And all the information we don't have yet to understand easily what's going on there.
Well, Millie,
and I wish I could live long enough to, because I think we will get there.
I think so. Thank you for that comment, and I will just go back to the very last statement. Many mysteries remain and may never be solved by our species, okay, Homo sapiens. For example, quantum mechanics. I mean, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the fact that it is a puzzling subject, and as Richard Feynman, the great physicist, said, nobody really understands it. You know how to use it, though. Maybe we will evolve beyond our mind's capacity today in future millennia, if not longer than that, eons, and have an intimate, intuitive understanding of the quantum world, but we don't have it now. And then you're talking about Freud going beyond mere matter. Well, then one thing I'm interested in is epistemology, philosophically, and the mind-matter problem, how mind What is matter a construction? I believe it's partially a construction, yes. Is mind a construction? I believe it may be, et cetera, et cetera. So these are very deep issues, and we are perplexed by many things. Yes.
Thank you for confusing me.
Okay. What?
Thank you for confusing me.
Okay, I'm sorry, Millie.
I just have one more burning question that's more than the general topic here, which is the first time I read about the heat death problem, I found it very depressing.
Yeah.
The thought, it just really depressed me. I'm like, I can live with the thought that there's no sentient God that cares about what we can do. I can live with the thought of a lot of thoughts like that. But the thought that all life will amount to nothing because everything will decay and there will never be life again is very depressing. Even the thought of the big bounce and the big crunch where everything's like crunched up and destroyed and then reborn, even that's somewhat encouraging because you know life will begin beyond down the road.
Right.
But the thought that it's just all going to stop and that's it is just so... That's like, I don't know how you could live with that thought. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on how do people deal with that, not in terms of the science, but in terms of the... How do we make sense of our world thinking that that might actually...
Well, Ursula Goodenough in The Sacred Depths of Nature, right towards the beginning of the book, she talks about herself when she was a young person, lying on the ground, looking up at the stars, and all wondrous and everything, and then she gets very depressed because thinking that it was just all finite and would come to an end. And as I mentioned, I think a sense of resignation is very important for mental health. You have to, just in general in everyday life, I think. You have to resign yourself to certain things you can't change. So, you know, it's a personal thing. I think you raise a very important thing there. Yeah?
I wanted to get your opinion since you said you're a condensed matter. Why do we have this disconnect between the subatomic and what we actually consider to be the natural world, though, in terms of why we develop these rules and saying quantum mechanics works at the subatomic level, though, and whatnot, though, but wait, we can't understand this middle gap, though, but then we understand Newtonian physics at our level, though, at the meter level. We don't have the nanometer level, and below that, we basically just say that.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you can challenge yourself with the task of being a reductionist and going from the most elementary laws like down to the atom. And well, the nucleus, the properties of the nucleus are largely, though not exclusively, separated, isolated from the properties of the atom, but of course not completely. But you have hyperfine interactions and things. But so the dream of the reductionist is to start with those elementary laws at the most microscopic level and then build everything up from there. Okay? I think that's a worthless project myself. You have emergence at the conceptual level of higher order concepts. And a wonderful paper on this is by the late Max Dresden, I think it was about 10 years ago in the American Journal of Physics, rather lengthy article for that publication, where he talks about how you have to invent new concepts if you're going to get anywhere at the higher levels of larger space and time phenomena. You just have to do it. Okay,
Kathy.
Oh, Kathy, I'm sorry.
I certainly appreciate your intellect and your lofty thoughts on all this, but while you were talking, I have some disjointed thoughts running through everything. And one of the thoughts is whatever is going to happen is going to happen.
Yeah.
And we have great minds working on all sorts of things, how to quell tornadoes and hurricanes and tsunamis, but they happen. And who would ever think that we would have a tornado right up the road
really?
In Pulaski and Dublin, you know.
Really?
And then
Draper, yeah.
And Draper, yeah. And the other thought was I had a very learned philosophy teacher who said, and I never got over this thought, but he said, you think that you have a choice. to do things, you know. But he says, you entertain the thought that it's already determined what's going to happen. And he says, you know, you think you had the opportunity, the choice to come to this class or to do basket weaving or whatever. But why didn't you go there instead of here? Mm-hmm. And you could say, well, I chose to do that, but in fact, it was determined you would to be in my place. We want to be here. Curtis and I used to argue about this all the time about, you know, you just think you could do that. Yeah. But, you know,
we'll have another whole session on
you know,
this is another issue I have struggled with over the years, free will versus determinism. Yeah. And I think to some degree it's a linguistic confusion.
Yeah.
But I think your initial point is well taken, Kathy. You cannot control you don't have total free will. Whatever free will we have, if we have any, it's limited.
Well, one other thing is you mentioned disorder increases. Is that what you said, disorder? Increase, and I was thinking
disorder increasing.
A more practical thing about when I was teaching, we would have a disorderly student, you know, who tried to erupt everything. You know, one rotten apple can spoil the whole barrel kind of thing. But that can happen unless you have control.
Yes.
And if you have control, then your disorder doesn't increase. I mean, it can increase this disorderly element could be thrown out of the class altogether.
Right.
So, you know, you opened up a lot of thoughts I hadn't had for a long time.
Okay, well, that's good. Dan?
When I gave my talk about brain research and how your brain works actually, starting 3 months ago, a few days before I gave it, I noticed this incredible statement about the history of science in Toynbee's book, A Historian's View of Religion. And he said that during the Enlightenment, our founding fathers, the physicists, who we now think of as the wonderful physicists, made a pact with the church to study only things that were not human. And they would leave all issues about God and humanity to the church. We will study only everything else. Now, I think that created a residuum of a huge flaw in physics. Because I believe that the only thing that's most important to study is human ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And physics, as it was created originally, cut itself off from that set of issues. Okay? So I will hand you all what I now call the Sword of Dan Enting. It's like, Democles' sword to cut the Gordian knot? If you are in a conundrum, okay, and you can't see what to do about it, cut it in half and pick the ethical, the side that's related to ethics.
Oh, sure.
Human life and ethics, and work on that.
Yes.
In terms of how we can really contribute to how we are, like that.
I cannot disagree with that. I'm not sure. I would never say that there's not a place for. Let me just put it this way.
Oh, go ahead.
Wonderful book, Science by Jacob Bronowski, is Science and Human Values. Really dense, packed. It's about 120 pages at the most, small paperback. Boy, that is a wealth of knowledge. You know, there's an old saying that science is ethically neutral. Well, I should say, qualify, basic research is ethically neutral, okay?
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to be done with the basic research if you're a researcher, okay? I can remember nonlinear optics back in the 60s and the first laser that was, the optical laser that was invented. And, it's used to fix retinas and eyes. It's used to make weapons. It's used industrially. So in that sense, science is ethically neutral. One thing that science is not is ethically neutral in its practice.
Totally agree. Totally
Absolutely.
In its practice.
In its practice, science must be done ethically with the highest degree of honesty. willingness to share information. A rejection of any kind of nationality. That's one of the wonderful things, even in the Cold War, you know, scientists always corresponding and trying to help the Soviet dissident scientists, okay? And organized skepticism is another one, you know, that's a value. That is a value. So science has its own values, and I think they're important ones, and must be practiced ethically, and we know that sometimes there are lapses there. Science is pretty well self-correcting when somebody gins up the data. Well, in physics it is. In physics it is. I think in biology it's more difficult. It's no aspersion on biologists.
That's probably right.
It's just more difficult.
Because careers depend on producing results. And I think that's true in every discipline.
Absolutely. That's true. Yeah,
I have one more question I've got to go, but this is so interesting to me. I just want to clarify, because my imagination has run wild with one thing you said, which is someone was talking about in one of the kind of things that go along with the heat death is that someone came up with a theory that thought increases when heat goes down. Because I'm imagining a universe where there's these sleeping life forms that dream for the rest of eternity. But I don't know if that's what that scientific theory was actually.
Yeah, we're going back to Dyson here, and where the thought processes run at a very high speed. So you might live, physically, you live for a second, but it subjectively it appears to you to be like a couple hundred years or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the idea, okay? And as I said, he presents a semi-plausible physical explanation of how that could happen, could possibly happen.
What's he saying, though? How does that tie in with the heat death?
Well, there's always going to be a tiny temperature difference. For example, if we are really in an exploding black hole, and that disputes the idea that the interior of a black hole is always pretty bad, okay? We could very well, if the universe were closed, we would indeed be inside a black hole. As seen from outside our own universe, okay? Black holes have a surface temperature, so there will always be a teeny-weeny temperature difference between things, just from thermal fluctuations, okay? So he's proposing that as the universe's temperature goes down to absolute zero, it goes down exponentially by any model, okay? It never really gets there, but it gets closer and closer and closer and closer, okay? So you just take your time and take your time and take your time and get the energy that you can. So you go into hibernation. So that was the idea. And then when you wake up, boom, your mind processes are going like crazy and you live a great life, a long life. Okay?
Boy.
Yeah, crazy.
On a slightly different subject, but something that you touched on, I've never quite understood the difference between things that tend to deteriorate and things that tend to organize on a higher and higher plane.
Yes.
What is entropy? Does that refer to one or the other of these things?
Entropy is very loosely defined as the degree of disorder, and the rule is in an isolated system the disorder increases. And I'll give you an example, the leaf of a plant, okay? As the leaf grows, it absorbs photons from the sun, okay? And it absorbs photons from the sun that are very few in number, relatively speaking, but very high in energy, okay? The leaf uses about 2% of that energy to grow itself in the plant, okay? So you see growth, you see organization happening here. A decrease in entropy if you look only at the tree. But what must the tree do? The tree must radiate its own energy back into space. If it only received energy, it would burn up. It has to be in thermal equilibrium. But when it radiates it at a lower temperature and in equilibrium between what comes in and what goes out. It radiates many, many more light particles or photons because each one is a wimpy you know, low energy photons. So entropy depends crucially on the number of particles in a system. So if you look at the region in the solar system, the space that includes radiation from Earth, the entropy is increasing. The disorder is increasing.
Things seem to develop in an ever increasing complexity from small, but is that only life and live things, but other things tend to, I mean, if you mix up a bunch of things in a bowl and stir them around, they even out. They don't organize. They just disperse.
That's right.
That's
so what things disperse and what things grow more complex?
The closed systems get more disorganized. If you have heat input to the system, then you can have growth.
Yes,
physics can't answer that question and doesn't try to.
What?
What kind of things become more organized or more complex?
Or is it over life?
There is no set of principles, I think, within physics
to bring that out. No.
So you have to use Dan Enting's sword again.
Okay, we'll use Enting's sword. Yeah. This way, Ann Kaufman really, really bangs on this issue, okay? That you cannot derive what happens in the biosphere and the process of evolution and what happens in the process of evolution from physics, because it's too historical, it's too contingent. All the events that really have a big impact are you cannot derive them, unless you believe in a thoroughgoing determinism, which I think is nutty. Okay, you know, the Laplace's demon, going back to the 1800s, if we had a God who knew everything, every little position and velocity of every particle, everything is rigidly, strictly determined.
Right. That's got to be wrong.
That's wrong.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Great agreement here.
I'm
glad you're here. And you should come back and do more of the same, I think. It would be really nice.
Okay, Mary doesn't see why it's wrong. That's good. You should be skeptical. Organized skepticism is
important. We'll have another meeting on free will versus determinism.
That's a good idea. With you here, though.
But let me just say that in quantum mechanics, you cannot determine position and velocity simultaneously. It's a fundamental limit on what we can know. Now, whether it's actually there is another question. David Bohm, the great physicist, devised a model.
Me too.
He devised a theory of quantum mechanics that makes sense, I think. But.
And it's deterministic, as I read in Scientific American years ago.
Yeah, it's not exactly clear.
Not exactly?
I'm not sure about that. It's
all right, but that's what I read. And that his theory was such that you could do quantum mechanics in a totally deterministic manner.
Well, particle electrons have definite positions, yes.
And things like that,
right. Yes. Right. Based on the electron's position.
Okay.
Well-defined positions.
Way cool. I'm glad you're here. This is good.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
Thank you, Frank. One more question.
Okay.
John.
I thought it was a cute story. If you know about in Catholicism about this principle that when the Pope says it, everybody has to believe it.
Ex cathedra.
Well, came out of the Vatican I Council, which was the same year that Huxley defined the term agnosticism. It was not used. In fact, it's called ex cathedra from the center of the cathedral.
I said cathedra, but
I said cathedra too.
Okay.
Used until about 1960, when Pope Pius said that all Catholics must believe that Mary was taken bodily up to heaven. And Joseph Campbell said, well, let's assume she's traveling at the speed of light. And he says, based on 2,000 years, she is 1/8 of the way to the center of the Milky Way. And what is she going to do when she gets there?
Yes.
Be absorbed into the giant black hole.
Good comment, John. Yes.
That's good. All right.
Well, I want to thank you all for your attention, but particularly we want to thank Frank for his well-prepared
Absolutely.
Challenge.
And I thank you.